That brings us to the final chapter of not only the unit, but the term. And in this chapter, we're going to look at things from the chromosome perspective. We had a chapter about the molecular basis of inheritance. That's finer detail than what we're looking at here. Genes are, remember, just parts of chromosomes. Now we're going to figure things out based on entire chromosomes. And in this opening slide, we have a cross that we've looked at before. There's nothing different about the cross. What kind of cross is this? What category would you put this into, this cross between a yellow round-seeded pea plant and a green wrinkled-seeded pea plant? Both of the parents are true breeding. It is a Mendelian case, but based on what is being crossed, what kind is it? Remember we had names for different kinds of crosses? Yes. What does the die mean? It means two, but what's it referring to here? Two what? Two characteristics or two genes. So it's a dihybrid cross. It's a hybrid cross because the parents differ in their traits from each other. And it's a dihybrid rather than a monohybrid because unlike a monohybrid cross in which you pay attention to just one characteristic, we're simultaneously paying attention to two different characteristics, right? Seed shape or texture and seed color. So all of that we've gone through before. We've already looked at this cross. But the new information that you see in the cartoons here is that it's not genes acting individually. We kind of pretended that they do in all of these crosses we talked about. We were ignoring all the other genes, remember? But it's not actually a single gene that is going anywhere by itself, right? A gene is just part of a chromosome. So that chromosome has a bunch of other genes on it, and wherever that gene goes that you're interested in, it's really just, it's kind of like a passenger on a boat. It's the entire boat going to the destination, not just that passenger. A bunch of other riders along with it. So in the cartoons here, there are two different chromosomes, even though N is greater than 2 for peas. The reason that we're showing you two chromosomes here is because they happen to be the chromosomes that carry the two genes we're interested in. So we're ignoring all the other chromosomes. But you see the entire chromosome, you don't see just a single color gene or texture gene. And the black marks represent what? What do the black marks on each chromosome represent? They are the alleles, and the word I was talking about, it refers to where the alleles are. What is that word? The alleles are the specific versions of that characteristic, of that gene, whatever it is. But that gene occupies a certain position on a chromosome. What is that position called?
The locus.
Yes, the locus. So you can tell where the locus is by seeing where the black mark is. And that particular black mark is the particular allele, and it's represented by a letter. So you can see that on the chromosome that has gene color, of course, this is a diploid individual, so there are two homologs of that, right? And they're true breeding, so you have a upper-upper Y and an upper-upper R for one, lower-lower Y, lower-lower R for the other, which makes it doubly recessive. Recessive color is green, recessive texture is wrinkled. Okay, well, it's not individual genes that get chosen in meiosis. When it comes time to making gametes in each of these parents, it's not genes that are randomly chosen, it's chromosomes, entire chromosomes that are chosen. And when a chromosome is chosen, that means all of the different genes that are riding on that chromosome get chosen. We're just ignoring those other genes, but they're there. So anyway, each parent makes a haploid gamete via meiosis. And since they're true breeding, it doesn't matter which chromosome gets chosen, right? Because you have one chromosome, I mean, you have two chromosomes with an upper Y. You can choose either one, you're going to get an upper Y gamete. Similarly for the R, and the other one's making lowercase ones. Nothing new there, we're just looking at chromosomes. If you then get these gametes together, that produces, through fertilization, the F1 generation. And all of the F1s, no matter how many get produced, are going to be genetically identical when all we care about are these two characteristics, right? They're all going to have a doubly heterozygous genotype, upper, lower Y, upper, lower R, every one of them. Which means every one of them, if you look at their seeds, once they grow up and produce their own, are going to be doubly dominant. Dominant in color, yellow, and dominant in shape, smooth. Okay? Then it comes time for them to make their gametes. And now there is a choice. I mean, it's always random, but now it matters which one is randomly picked. Well, here we get these two boxes that are shown on either side of the of this figure. Two laws that are important, the Mendelian laws, really, they're named in his honor because he figured this out. The law of segregation and the law of independent assortment. Well, we've talked about these things before, I just didn't give you the names of the laws, really. But it's important to realize that both of these laws have to do with things that are happening during meiosis. And specifically, meiosis one. So the law of segregation, as you see, says that the two alleles for each gene, because we're talking about diploid individuals, so there are two alleles, one on each of the two homologs that carry that particular gene, they separate, which is what segregation means, during gamete formation. Well, gamete formation in diploids is done by meiosis. So this is occurring in meiosis one. And specifically, when does the law of segregation come into play? What part of meiosis? Not for segregation. Anaphase 1. Because anaphase is the separation phase, right? So that actually, even though I've just mentioned it first, is actually happening after what's happening described by the law of independent assortment. We talked already extensively about independent assortment, and that happens in metaphase one, because that's when lining up occurs. Well, that's what assortment is, the lining up between the two poles. So as you see here, it says that alleles of genes on non-homologous chromosomes assort independently. Non-homologous means chromosomes of different types, like the number 7 and the number 4. They're carrying a totally different set of genes, right? They're like separate boats. They each have many passengers, but they're separate boats, and so they can go separate directions. Specifically, they can both go to one cell, or they can go to one cell and the other one goes to the other cell, depending on how they assort at metaphase. We've talked about this. And so this explains why you can get this 9:3 to 3:1 ratio that we've already talked about. Since there's independent assortment, that means you should be able to get all four of the possible combinations of the alleles involved in the two parents. There's two alleles for flower color, there's two alleles for flower texture, and because of independent assortment, you should be able to get all four combinations. Two of those combinations are going to be like one parent or the other, right? They're going to be yellow and smooth or green and wrinkled. Those are called parental types, even though they're offspring, because they're exactly like one parent or the other. The other two are going to have a combination of both parents, and those are called recombinant types, either yellow and wrinkled, not like either parent, or green and smooth, not like any parent. And they're 9:3 to 3:1. We've already looked at the Punnett square on that. All right, well, let's go to 2. We see at the top in cartoon form drawings of some flies, specifically fruit flies. Did I put that away? Specifically, the fruit fly genus is called Drosophila, in case you see that word, you're talking about fruit flies. And they species of Drosophila are used extensively in genetic research because they're really easy to grow in the lab. And at home, actually, you just keep a banana peel out for a few hours and you'll have some fruit flies. But they're easy to keep alive in the lab, and they have basically a week. You only have to have a week for a generation. So you can go through many generations in your experiment in fairly short amount of time. So they're used for a lot of genetic analyses. Well, the photographs here, the large photographs below, are real photographs of eyes. And eye color is the characteristic we're going to look at here. The wild type is the phrase, remember, that we give to the most frequently occurring phenotype in the population. It's not necessarily the dominant. It often is. But wild type simply means the trait that most individuals in the population have, more than any other. And for eye color, the wild type is this reddish color. There's also white-eyed individuals, though, as you can see here. What we're going to see, though, is that this is not a simple Mendelian characteristic where you just have red dominant over white and everything is just like the flower colors. There's going to be a difference here. So let's go on to three and explain it. Now, for the P generation, we have a red-eyed individual crossed with a white-eyed individual. So it doesn't seem to be anything different from how we've talked about it, other than it's animals instead of plants, but that's not really a difference. What information, though, is shown in that P generation that we didn't look at before? The sex, exactly. This is the symbol for female, this is the symbol for male. Well, we didn't care in the pea plant example. There was a male and a female, of course. But we didn't care whether the purple one was a male or a female, or whether the white one was a male or a female. It could have been either in both cases. Here it does matter, though, and that's why it's listed. So we have a red-eyed female crossed with a white-eyed male. And when you actually do that cross with however many replicates you do it for, you produce the F1 generation. And this doesn't seem like it's any different from what we've looked at before either, because since red is dominant over white, you would expect the F1 to be all red-eyed, right? And all fully red-eyed, which is exactly what happened here. So it doesn't seem like this is any different. But it is, even though I haven't explained why yet. It actually is going to continue to seem like it's no different when you go to the F2, because these F1s, if you then cross the brothers and sisters to make the F2, then 3/4 of the F2 are red-eyed and 1/4 are white-eyed, which is exactly the ratio you'd predict if it were just like pea plants, right? But what's different about it is what's happening sex-wise. In the pea plants, there was a 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio, meaning 75% of the offspring were purple-flowered, 25% were white-flowered. But that didn't say anything about sex. So those 75% that were purple, however many there are, could be either male or female. The 25% that were white could be either male or female. Here, that's not the case. All of the females in the F2, represented by these two identical pictures, all of the females are red-eyed, half of the males are red-eyed, and half of them are white-eyed. So that's what's different here. And specifically what's different is that in the pea plant example of flower color, The gene for flower color is on one of the autosomes. Do you remember what autosomes are? I gave you that definition when we first looked at a karyotype of humans. An autosome is a chromosome other than a sex chromosome. So in species that have sex chromosomes, there's two major categories of chromosomes. Autosomes, some number of them, and sex chromosomes. All right. And for an autosome, there is truly homologous chromosomes. However many autosomes there are that many of truly homologous pairs. What I mean by truly homologous is that they are not only the same size, they have the same number and types of genes. Even though the alleles might be different in the two homologs, all of the genes are the same. But if you think back to that human karyotype that we looked at, the sex chromosome, the pair of sex chromosomes in that example, was one X and one Y. Remember, they were not the same size. I said at the time that they're considered to be homologous, but they're not truly homologous. They can't be if they're not the same size, right? One of the sex chromosomes in humans, the X, carries a lot more genes than the Y does, which is much smaller. They still synapse, but they're not truly homologous in that respect. And similarly with fruit flies, they also use the XY system, just like us mammals. And it's also true that the X chromosome in flies is much bigger than the Y, even though it's not really shown here as being the Y smaller, it really is. What this means is that the Y chromosome only has some of the genes that are also on the X. The X has all of the sex chromosomes genes. So anything that's on the Y is also on the X. But in addition to all those, the X has other ones that aren't also on the Y because it's smaller. Well, it just happens that this eye color gene that we're looking at in fruit flies is one of these ones that are on the X chromosome but not on the Y chromosome. And this is another exception to normal Mendelian genetics. And so this brings up the definition of sex-linked. A gene can be sex-linked. Now, what that phrase means is simply that gene, whatever it is on or has its locus on a sex chromosome rather than an autosome. So for any given gene, there's two major categories: a sex-linked gene, if it is, or an autosomal gene. Well, for any gene that's autosomal, a diploid individual is going to have two alleles. Right? Those are the examples we started with. And that's where you get the familiar ratios that we studied. But in eye color for fruit flies, it's a sex-linked gene. And that means even though the eye color has nothing to do with the sex determination, the sex chromosomes determine the sex of the individual for other reasons not related to this eye thing, which means that males are going to differ compared to females in their eye color simply because they differ in the number of alleles. A female in fruit flies is an XX. She has both X's, and therefore she's just like the autosomal example, even though it's a sex-linked gene still for her because it's on a sex chromosome. She has two of them, though, two alleles. So it operates just like an autosomal gene, On a male, though, he has only one allele, not two, because he's XY, and Y doesn't have the gene on it, only X does. Now, remember the three major categories that correspond to possible genotypes: homozygous dominant, heterozygous, homozygous recessive, right? Well, those don't apply here when we're talking about a male. Because whether an individual is homozygous or heterozygous, both of those words refer to the situation of having two alleles, right? A homozygous individual means both of the two alleles are the same. Heterozygous means the two alleles are different from each other. But a male, for a sex-linked gene like eye color, does not have two alleles, so you can't use words that refer to having two alleles. Instead, a male for a sex-linked gene is called hemizygous. Hemi means half. Same as demi and semi, they all mean half. So let's look at these chromosomes in the F2 generation. I mean, let's look at the whole cross again. I'm sorry. It starts over after conclusion here from the beginning. But now we're looking at their actual chromosomes. So this is back to the parents. Okay? Red-eyed female, white-eyed male. Well, she is not only red-eyed, she is homozygous. Because both of her alleles are the red type. By the way, here is yet another standard. We're used to using letters that indicate the dominant genotype, the dominant allele. Well, here, W, meaning white, is actually the recessive allele, but if you put a plus superscript, it makes it actually the dominant version instead. Confusing to have all these multiple ones, but that's what it means. W plus really means two red versions. The male has only one allele, though, because only the X chromosome has this allele. The Y doesn't have it. So he's hemizygous, and this one happens to be hemizygous white. Notice that in a male, since he's hemizygous, whatever allele you have fully determines the trait, because that's the only allele you have. So it doesn't matter whether it's dominant, recessive. It's the only one you have. Okay. When they get crossed to make the F1 generation, you can represent that with just a two-box Punnett square, because this female can only produce one kind of egg, right? Not only with respect to eye color, but with respect to the sex chromosome, right? When she makes an egg, since she is XX, the sex chromosome that she's going to pass on in that gamete has to be an X. And since both of her eye color genes carried by her X's is the same version, red, that means she can make only one kind of an egg. It's going to have an X chromosome with a red-eyed allele on it. He's a male, so just by being male, he can make two different kinds of sperm, right? He has an X chromosome to donate or a Y chromosome. And the X has the white version. So these are the only possible gametes. That's enough for the Punnett square, and therefore there's two possible zygotes. This explains why the F1 generation, though, was all red-eyed. Because red is dominant over white. This left half of the Punnett square represents all of the females. Because to make a female, you have to get an X sperm and an X egg together. Right? Red is dominant over white, so all of the females were white-eyed. Oh, sorry, right here. But all the males were red-eyed because in order to make a male, you have to get an X and a Y together, right? Well, the Y has to come from the male. They're the only ones that have male, which means the mother has to give the X, and she's red-eyed. It dominates over white, so all the males were also red-eyed. Even though they were not genetically the same genotype-wise, they were phenotypically identical. Now you have these crossed with each other, brother and sister, to make the F2. This is a heterozygous female. All of the F1s are females are heterozygous, right? Because they got a red allele from their mother in the P generation and a white allele from the father in the P generation. Therefore, all of these heterozygous females in the F1 can produce two kinds of eggs. They're both X. They have to be carrying X because they're coming from females. But there's one of them is an X with a white, one of them is an X with a red. The males are all red-eyed, so they can donate either a red-eyed carrying X or a Y with no allele for eye color. Therefore, you have four possibilities, right? In the left column is the female possibilities in the F2. Well, because red is dominant over white, all of the females are red-eyed. But the reason there are two of them shown here originally is because half of the females are homozygous dominant. Half of them are homozygous. Half of them are heterozygous. You see that? Can't tell them apart by looking at them, but they're genetically distinct. And this shows you on the right side that half of the males should be red-eyed because they got a red eye color X from their mother, and the other half got a white eye X from their mother, which means they're white-eyed. Half of them are red-eyed, half of them are white-eyed. That's sex linkedness. And you might see the phrase X-linked. That's really just sex-linked in any species that uses the XY system, so typically used for humans. But X-linked is just an example of sex-linked. Sex-linked is the more general term. Any single gene is either sex-linked or not. It makes sense to talk about a single gene being sex-linked or not. I say that now because that's distinct from the word linked by itself, which I'll talk about in a bit, if today. So, we have in slide 4 a photomicrograph of X and Y chromosomes. You can see that there is a tremendous difference in size. Whatever genes are on this Y chromosome are also on the X. But there's parts on the X that just aren't there on the Y. Therefore, those are those sex-linked genes I'm talking about. Actually, the ones that are on both are still considered sex-linked genes, but they're not going to have the same effect like we saw in the fruit flies, because if they're on both of them, it's going to act just like it's an autosome, since both sexes have two alleles. But technically, they are still sex-linked. If they're sex-linked, though, in such a way that only one gender, the two genders have different amounts of alleles, then you'll have that same effect that we saw in fruit flies. This brings us to 5, which is not at all an exhaustive listing, but it shows you some of the variety of sex determination mechanisms used in sexual species. Now, one reason that this is not nearly an exhaustive list is that notice that every one of these examples is animals, which are only one group of sexual species, right? No plants, no fungi here. They exist still, so the protists are sexual as well. But even if we just restrict ourselves to animals, there's more possibilities than are shown here. This is just some examples to give you the idea of how of the fact that it's not like it works in humans for all species. Let's start with humans, though, because that's most familiar, being humans. We are members of the so-called XY system. We've talked about this a little bit already, right? The X and the Y are the two versions in the population of sex chromosomes. And that's why in that human genotype that we looked at originally, there are 23 types of chromosomes, but they weren't numbered 1 through 23. The autosomes were numbered 1 through 22, and then you just had the sex chromosomes labeled as either XX or XY. Well, for humans, N is what number? 23. And so what does 44 plus XY mean? Well, the 44 represents the fact that a diploid male human, of course, has two of each of the 22 kinds of autosomes, for a total of 44 autosomes, plus two sex chromosomes, but a male is, one of them is an X and one of them is a Y. 44 plus the two sex chromosomes add up to 46, which you would expect a diploid to have, right? A female is 44 plus XX. All right, well, when they make gametes, the gametes genotypes are represented as 22 plus X or 22 plus Y. Well, notice here that only a male or a member of an XY system, like a human, only a male can make different kinds of sperm when it comes to sex chromosomes. The female has to make an X egg. She can't make a Y egg because if she had a Y, she wouldn't be female. This is why the father determines the sex of the offspring. The mother has to give an X to the offspring because that's all she has. The father can give an X or a Y, and therefore the father determines whether the zygote, the offspring, is XY or XX, female or male. All right. Next up is this grasshopper representing what is called the X0 system. That's actually a 0, not an O, but most people call it the XO system. 0, though, the reason it's a 0 is it represents that there's nothing there. Not a different type of chromosome, it's just the chromosome is not there. So notice that in females, in this species, there's how what's N for this female, for this grasshopper? For the female. What is it?
11.
12. 11 autosomes, and you have two each if you're a diploid, so there's 22 autosomes, plus an X and an X. Well, X is the 12th. The sex chromosome is the 12th type. But unlike humans, sex determination in grasshoppers is not based on what type of sex chromosome you have. There's only one possible type of sex chromosome here, the X chromosome. But what defines you as a female is that you have two of them, two X's. If you have only one, then you're a male. All right? That's the X0 system. The one that's most similar to us, and we've talked about this in lab, is the ZW system in most birds. Like the owls you studied, right? It's exactly the same as the XY system, except it's reversed when it comes to who determines the sex of the offspring. Because the male in the ZW system is the one that has two of the same chromosome. Two Zs makes a male. Therefore, he can make only one kind of sperm. It's going to carry a Z chromosome, no matter which one you pick. The female in birds determines the sex of the offspring because she can give a Z chromosome in her egg or a W chromosome in her egg. Other than that, it works the same way. So what's N here? 39. 38 autosomes and a sex chromosome. Two types. All right, now the bottom one from our point of view is the weirdest. I'm sure it doesn't seem weird to a bee if they think about it, but it's weird from our point of view. It is the so-called haplodiploid system. One thing that's weird right away from our point of view is that these species do not have any sex chromosomes. All right, so there's only autosomes. And for this species, the N is 16. 16 different types of autosomes. Without sex chromosomes, there has to be something else that determines the sex. In this case, it's the ploidy that determines the sex. If an individual has two of each of the 16 types, in other words, if that individual is diploid, that makes that individual a female. One of each, a haploid, makes him a male. So that's quite different from us right away. But it leads to some interesting things. Unlike most animals, bees or other haplodiploid system species can actually reproduce without getting gametes together, without fertilization, in other words. So a female bee is a female because she's diploid, right? She has two of every chromosome. Well, like us as diploids, when she produces a gamete, an egg, since she's female, it's going to be haploid, right? It's produced by meiosis. Well, you can use that egg for fertilization like we do, like we have to, right? An egg either is going to be fertilized or just die as an egg. But in a bee, she can mate, receive sperm, and in that case, her eggs can be fertilized. Or she can choose not to mate, lay eggs, and those eggs will actually develop into adults without being fertilized. That's the big difference with us. If she chooses not to mate and produces eggs that develop, those eggs are all going to be haploid, right? And they're going to remain haploid because they're not being fertilized. So they will all develop into males. She can have sons, as many as she wants, just by herself. No mating. If she does choose to mate, then that means all of her eggs that get fertilized will, by definition, be diploid, right? Because you're getting both gametes together, which is going to make all of those daughters females, depending on whether she mates or not. And there's more weirdness. When you think about this, what this means is that any male bee, which is a haploid, has no father, right? Because if he had a father, then that would make him a female, because a father would make it diploid. So all males have no father, and they can't have any sons, because if they do mate, their sperm is going to get fertilize an egg, which is going to make it diploid, and that's going to be a daughter only. But even though they don't have a father and they can't have a son, every male does have a grandfather, right? Because the mother is diploid. She had to come from a male and a female getting together. So every male has a grandfather, and every male can have a grandson because his daughters can reproduce by mating to produce males. That's pretty interesting. It just shows you some of the variety used just within animals. I think I'll stop there.